Thank you very much. It's such an honor for me to be here and to give this talk on diversity. I actually struggled with the kind of talk that I would present today. So I've decided that I'm going to spend the latter years of my life on a simple goal. I want to make everybody at the University of Arizona into a math major. In fact, this response that you just gave me was exactly the response that the faculty gave me when they asked me to take this job of associate head, and I told them that's what I was going to do. Now, given that goal, I'm a miserable failure. We have 28,000 students, and I've only been able to convince 1,200 of them that they should be majoring or minoring in mathematics. So I have a lot of work to do in the years to come. And so I could talk about the efforts to increase the number of math majors, but I didn't know if that was the appropriate talk to give here because I really didn't know what the student population is at this university. And so to give a public address on these methods that I use, I thought may not be appropriate. So let me just give you an example of what I do. So I have access to all student records. So when a student arrives at our university, enrolled in second semester calculus, I am so excited. They get a message from me saying, I think you should add math as a major. I send out 5,000 messages a semester. If a student comes in having taken two semesters of calculus now, enrolled in third semester as a first year student, oh my God, you know. I have them come into my office. I already have their PhD plan for them when they come into my office. So let me tell you a little bit about Raimundo, who was just featured in our weekly news. Raimundo is an unusual student, comes from Douglas, Arizona. This is a border town. Border towns don't have a strong scientific culture. He somehow managed to take two semesters of calculus and differential equations at a community college. Oh, he got a message from me, come in to see me. So he's enrolled in third semester calculus. I told him you should be a math major. And he says, oh. All right, so he sort of said yes, but it was not a very enthusiastic yes. But you know, what difference does it make? He's making me happy. He has to take third semester calculus anyway, right? Okay, comes in at the end of the semester. Okay, linear algebra, you should be taking linear algebra. Not too excited about this. If you take linear algebra, I point out, I will get you an internship this summer, a paid internship. This is a very funny thing. I show students these internship opportunities. They're called research experiences for undergraduates. All of you should be applying to these. I put the picture up to him, and it says $3,250. And he said, I can't pay $3,000 to go spend the summer there. No, I said, they're paying you, plus your airfare, plus your living expenses. Okay, so he'll take linear algebra. Okay, so he went to Rice University for the Summer Institute in Statistics, and he came back motivated. He thought, okay, this is good. All right, so he continued on. He's in engineering physics, and he took some mathematics that were very applied. All right, so now I'm talking to him about his second summer experience. Now, I tell my students my function is to advise them. Their function is to make a decision. All right, so I presented various opportunities. He chose this program to work in a forest in Oregon State. You know, working in a forest in Oregon State, it's going to be great fun, but it didn't strike me as the best mathematical experience. In the middle of that summer, he writes back to me and he says, I've completely changed my program of study. I'm dropping engineering physics. I'm going to major in physics and pure mathematics. Could you arrange my schedule for next semester so I can get into abstract algebra and advanced calculus, because I realize that in order to address these problems, you have to understand abstract mathematics. So he completed the requirements for the math major now in his third year, having taken these very abstract courses. We're now talking about his third summer coming up. He applied to the Penn State Mass program. I don't know about if you know about this program. This is a Penn State. How many in math? How many math students are here? Okay. Penn State Mass program. This is run by mathematicians from the former Soviet Union. Very intense mathematical study. You spend the summer there, and then you can also spend another semester at Penn State. So this kid who came from Douglas had no idea what mathematics was about. He is now at Penn State, and he has completely changed his program of study. He is now thinking of taking an extra year to take graduate courses in topology, which he feels are necessary to be able to understand these problems that he was addressed to. I think that by the time this student has graduated, he would be a wonderful catch for some of these elite universities, and that concerns me. Because in 2002, I met a young woman named Sarah from, again, Douglas, wanting to study engineering. Again, I found her an internship after her first year at IBM. I worked with her. Okay, I wasn't as persuasive with Sarah as I was with Raimundo. She only minored in math. Is Sarah Brighton around? Susan Brighton, sorry. Oh, there she is, way in the back, hiding in the back, right? Wonderful resource for MIT. I met her at one of the SACNAS conferences, introduced Sarah to the Converge program. She applied. She came, had a wonderful summer experience. She's now going to graduate school at MIT, she tells me. And she was so confident about it that she only applied here. And then they turned her down in 2006. I was shocked in mechanical engineering. How could they turn down this very bright woman coming from the borders in Arizona? I was so furious at MIT, I called them up and I said, what are you doing? Well, there was a very nice person in mechanical engineering that talked to me, and he explained very politely, very promising student, really competitive. But the percentage of international students is growing at MIT, and they could not offer her a position. I think that when you're bringing in international students and turning down qualified US citizens, you are ill-serving the scientific community in this country. And I've decided I'm going to be talking about that at this presentation. I'm not going to be talking about the stuff that I've been doing. I want to talk about the impact that the policies, I'm not talking about people, I'm talking about the policy, has had on us. So I want to emphasize, I've had a charmed and magical life, right? I grew up in Tucson with that same kind of grinding poverty that was part of being a Chicano in the United States. My father died when I was 9, and my mother just barely made ends meet, but somehow I was able to get an education. So I've had a magical life. I've been able to create new mathematics. I've been able to teach mathematics. And for some reason, I always thought that mathematics was applicable in spite of the fact that I'm a number theorist. And so I did some work for the Navy, and I got some patents, but I wanted to point out my co-inventor is James Bond. You know, if that isn't magical, I don't know what is. So I use this word Chicano, and maybe I should explain what that is. So I grew up in Tucson at a time when the Anglo community was trying to make us believe that we were second-class citizens. They used the word underprivileged to describe the culture that I came from. Underprivileged. We in a society that have this wonderful food, this music, this family structure, and they somehow viewed us as underprivileged. They would call us wetbacks and beaners with some nice adjectives thrown in to better describe their feelings towards us. So we were supposed to be second-class citizens. I just could never buy that. Then we would go to Mexico. Okay, so I've never studied Spanish in my life, right? I grew up in American schools. In fact, they would punish us for speaking Spanish in schools. I'd go into Mexico, and our cousins would criticize us for not speaking Spanish well, and they would call us gringos. So here we were, kids growing up in the Southwest. Americans didn't want us. Mexicans didn't want us. And we had to call ourselves Mexican Americans. I mean, that's insulting. So in the 1960s, this word Chicano came about, and I thought it better described our experience. So Chicano sort of means Mexican Americans. But of course, the Hispanic population in this country is complex and varied, and there isn't any one word that is going to describe the Hispanic population. Now, I want to emphasize strongly that I am talking about policy issues, right? I am not talking about people, as I mentioned some of these things. So I'm very nervous about that. So I'd like to talk about diversity. Thank you. So what does it mean? Well, in fact, when you look at mathematics departments around the country, they're incredibly diverse. I mean, they have people from every language group, every continent. So why do we push diversity? Well, I don't think that this is what diversity means. So NSF has this category of historically underrepresented minorities. These are Hispanics, African Americans, and Native Americans. And of course, this designation only applies to people who are US citizens and permanent residents. Now, we simply don't have a representation of Hispanic Americans in our mathematics departments. And the situation for Native Americans is worse than bleak. One problem that exists is that we have no advocates for the Native American population in our mathematics departments. There is no one around paying attention to them. In fact, it's even worse than this. I had a Navajo student call me up who was accepted to this university in the Southwest, this university that used to be part of Navajo land. He was accepted into their master's degree program. But the head of the graduate committee said, "We're not giving you money because we are sure you're going to fail." So this student who I had met at a SACNAS conference called me up and said, "Should I go there?" He says, I happen to have family in that city. I think I can survive until October." I said, "No, you shouldn't go there. They will funk you out." So I called a friend of mine somewhere else. This person, in fact, got a master's degree in mathematics. He's now returned to the reservation, and I've heard just wonderful things about him as a teacher, and I think he's going to have an impact on the Navajo community. So I don't think we're paying attention to the U.S. population, and I think we need to be doing more about it. But the problem is, again, is that we don't have people on the inside who are making decisions. Now, I think the goal of diversity initiatives are to educate the citizens of this country. It is not to have representation of all different cultures in our mathematics departments. The goals are that if you are an undergraduate in this country, that you should be able to participate in higher education. And in fact, that is simply not happening. So our mathematics departments should reflect the diversity, and it is not about importing international scientists and calling them minorities. There's something again. So I want to talk a little bit about this. Excuse me, just a moment. This thing.
Just hang out.
All right, last time. We're all set. So I was reading this document that MIT just produced on diversity. And they describe the population here among the faculty, describing how many members of the faculty are in fact underrepresented minorities. Now, the National Science Foundation has this category of underrepresented minorities, but it stipulates that to be counted as an underrepresented minority, you have to be a US citizen or permanent resident. Now, MIT says that 6% of the population among the faculty are underrepresented minority, but I want you to notice something very cute about this, and it says, disregard federal guidelines. It's 6%. So, of course, if you make your own definitions, you can do whatever you like. Now, if you look at the definitions where you include citizenship, then that population is about 1%. So you see a small rise, but not substantial. Many of us in the minority community are very concerned about importing talent from abroad and labeling these people as minorities. And first of all, you wonder, why would somebody want the label minority? You know, it's if you look at Nobel Prize winners, they're in the minority. But that's not the connotation that the word minority has, right? So I got all of my degrees at the University of Arizona. So I was having a party at the house, and one of the students had a little bit too much to drink and told me that the only reason I was hired was because I was a minority. Right? Now, the fact that I got my degrees there makes me suspect enough, but I'll bet you anything, they never tell the other two faculty members who also got their PhDs there that there was some preferential treatment given to them. So the word minority has a very negative connotation. And why would anybody want to assume such a term? I am a minority. I understand that. But why do you want to bring that term onto yourself? It is sort of odd that you would bring in Latin American scientists into this country and somehow label them minorities when they've never gone through this experience. I mean, if you're in a math class and you're doing poorly and they tell you, you know, you're no good because you're Mexican. I mean, they don't tell you that in Mexico, right? And yet, this is the minority experience. So I like to say that as an undergraduate, the only advice I had was bad advice. So I think we have to be much, much more concerned about bringing in... Yes? Okay, so this is a number that is rising, and it's probably over 25% now. I don't know what the percentage of minority faculty is at MIT. It's probably not, it's a sizable percentage, I would think, but I really don't know, right? Our math department was 50% foreign-born for a while. That is decreasing a little bit. That's not unusual for mathematics departments around the country. Okay, but I don't have the figures on MIT. I don't know what that is. So the fact that we're minorities coming into a university, I mean, we experience certain clashes in culture. So let me tell you one of the stupidest things I ever did in my life. So as a graduate student, I had an internship at Bell Labs. And I wrote a paper on a conjecture of one of the mathematicians there. And I spent 10 weeks working very hard, met the most amazing mathematician. I played ping pong with Paul Erdős almost every day. It was just an amazing experience. And at the end, a recruiter from Bell Labs came to talk to me. And he said, we'd like you to apply to Bell Labs. Well, that's nice. I told him, I wouldn't apply here. I wouldn't work here if this was the last place on earth. This is the coldest bunch of individuals I have ever been in my life. Now, I'm a well-balanced person, but somehow there was a real clash of cultures between being a Mexican-American coming from the Southwest and going to New Jersey and having to habitate in this culture. In fact, I hear this over and over again from minority students. I hear it often from women having to function in mathematics departments. So, you know, we do have, when you bring in minority students, there are cultural differences in just the way you greet each other that tend to make it uncomfortable. Now, I've been in this profession for a long time. I've gotten over this. I know how to function. But for many of us, that's been our experience in this country. Now, you know, I hear this over and over again, right? That we want to attract minority students into graduate programs, but always there is this, you know, we want qualified, we want the best students, right? So again, this business about minority and the connotation that it brings. A recruiter comes to my campus, makes an appointment to see me, and he says, we want to diversify our workforce, we want to bring more minorities in, and then sort of like, but of course, we want some good ones. Because we're minority, right? We're all in a certain class. So when you talk to graduate programs about bringing in students, they always say they want the best students. But I don't know, what does this best mean? I mean, is there a well-defined term for best? Does it mean, say in a math department, does it mean best mathematically prepared? Well, here's a problem. See, so if you're an undergraduate math major in Mexico, that means you took 4 years of math. That's all you took. There is no flexibility. You have a program of study, you took 4 years of math. So by the time you get your bachelor's degree, you look like you have a master's degree. Now, compare that to one of our mathematics majors in this country. We insist on students having a liberal arts education. At our university, there's a rule. You cannot take more than one-third of your courses in any one department. And so when you compare an international student to a domestic student, well, of course, the international students look so much better, right? So it's sort of an odd situation that we have in this country, is that a student that doesn't have a choice, if they want to be a math major, they have to go through our university. This is the system of education that we've created for them. And yet, when they do, graduate programs ridicule them for not being as well prepared as international students. I happen to think, and of course I ran our graduate program for a while, that, you know, there are wonderful international students coming in all the time with great coursework. But it's not so easy to find out which of those students have creativity. So departments, research departments claim that international students come in with much better preparation than domestic students. And the question is, does this lead to better research? So I found this article in the 2005 notices of the American Mathematical Society, written by Gerald Grossman, who actually got his PhD here at MIT. And what he did was this. He got data from Math Reviews. So Math Reviews is a journal where all, not all, but lots of articles are reviewed. And what he did was he wanted to find out, how many articles does a mathematician publish? And it's shocking. So 43% of mathematicians that appear in math reviews have one article in their lifetime. 43%. By the way, this doesn't count the mathematicians who never published even their thesis, and there are a lot of those. So the data shows that 75% of mathematicians publish less than 5 papers. This is data up to 2005. That's not commanding data. So, you know, if we had focused on domestic students, would this data be worse? I can't imagine it. Now, are there barriers to bringing in minority students? So, you know, people don't like to talk about race issues. It's very uncomfortable. So, again, when I was a kid, it was clear that there were very negative attitudes directed towards us. But when you're in a community and people say things to you, they call you names, you know, you are in a community. In a way, there's a way of buffering that. You're defended by the people around you. You can go home and there's your uncles and your aunts and your cousins who you can talk to, and somehow it's not so bad. But when I went in the Navy in 1968, there was such horrible racism. There was just no question about it. I mean, they couldn't differentiate me between me and an Indian. And so sometimes I was Indian and sometimes I was just a dumb Mexican. It just didn't make any difference. But there's a different characteristic when you're alone. And in fact, just a couple months ago, the only African-American student in the dorm had these racial slurs written down her door. So racism is very much a part of culture. And we saw what happened in Congress just a few weeks ago. And so one question is, are departments racist in their attitudes towards the minority community? Well, I would say no, right? Not blatantly so. But let me tell you an experience I had with the National Security Agency. So in the late 90s, I decided I wanted to work for the National Security Agency. So I applied, went down, took their tests, and then I had this exit interview. And they said, if you work for the National Security Agency, you can't have contact with foreign nationals. I said, I work at a university. And the woman said, besides that. Well, what besides that? What does that mean, besides that? She said, you can't have contact with foreign nationals. I said, I live on the border. You know, we're 60 miles away. I have cousins that come across the border and visit me. I'm supposed to tell them I can't talk to them because I work for NSA? The woman said, if you want to work here, you have to follow the rules. Are you willing to comply with this policy? Half an hour. I just couldn't believe they're doing this to me. Finally, I said, okay, I'm not willing to comply with these policies. This person wrote it down. They didn't offer me a job. Now at the time, okay, fine, you know there's other jobs, but I mean, it's so annoying. I went to Vietnam, that's okay, right? If you go to the Vietnam Wall and put your hand on it, draw a circle around there, there's a Hispanic name. But I can't work at the National Security Agency. They don't allow Chicanos to work there because we live on the border. Now, okay, so a few years later, somebody wrote an article in the notices saying, oh, it's wonderful working at the National Security Agency. More people should apply. I immediately wrote a letter saying, I would love to work there, but I can't. They won't hire Chicano mathematicians. I got a call that very day from National Security Agency, you know, saying, sorry, those were the rules. We're now changing. If you want to, you can now apply. I can assure you that you could now work at the National Security Agency. Now, they're not racist. They just have rules that they've put in place that serve as institutionalized racism, perfectly reasonable perhaps, right? And so as you are trying to diversify your own workforce in bringing in students that look very different from you, one of the things that you need to ask yourselves is, what are your rules are in place? Are there any there that serve to as a hindrance to bringing in minority students? So, best students, okay, I don't know. I don't know what best students mean. But actually, maybe best doesn't refer to the students. Maybe it refers to us as an institution. What we want is the best students who can promote our reputation. That's maybe what best means. Okay, I can't even read this one without laughing. I mean, could it mean that best actually means what's best for this country? Should we bring in the best students that would serve to motivate future generations of mathematicians and scientists so that we have a more diverse culture in our mathematics departments? You know, I ran our graduate program. I've never seen anything like this. And yet, NSF does have this strategic plan. And they recognize that the workforce in the United States is aging. And in order to meet the demand, we need to bring in women and minorities and persons with disabilities into STEM careers. If we, as a university, accept money from the National Science Foundation, should we also be supporting their strategic plan? So here's some data on PhD. Someone was asking me this earlier. So in the late 1970s, about 75% of the PhDs went to domestic students. You notice how this figure began to fall. And currently it's under 50% with a sort of slight rise. And we know that, in fact, there's some other countries that are actually developing expertise that they don't want to export their students. So this supply of international students may not be around. Now, PhDs in math, that's correct. This is percentages, right? Now, I happen to think we should always have large numbers of international students in our graduate programs, but 50%, I think, represents a system that is out of balance. Now, the impact of this, I think, is quite severe. So, you know, it's clear that a doctorate from a Research One university provides you with the pedigree to be attractive to any mathematics department in the country. That's clear, right? Getting a PhD from the University of Arizona, you know, it doesn't compare to a PhD from the elite universities. And so 40% of the PhDs that come from these elite universities, 40% of the PhDs come from these elite universities, and half of those are international. So one of the things that struck me about this document that I read that MIT just produced is you can sort of think of a fountain as a PhD production. So you have the elite schools that are producing the PhDs. And these PhDs can, in fact, go down and they can hold jobs at any other place. And a few stay there. Now, you're interested in diversity. So how do you achieve diversity? Well, maybe there could be a drop from one of the lower tiers that's going to rise up and hit a higher tier. And how long do you think we should wait before that happens? And in fact, that's the standard recruitment procedure for universities. Instead of seeding the top with minority students, they're waiting for people to come from the bottom up. I think that this is the wrong way to go. We have such small numbers of minority students pursuing STEM degrees that until we begin producing PhDs at the higher level, we're simply not going to affect faculty employment at the Research One universities. Now, you notice that there was this decrease in US students, right? So what caused this decrease? Is it because Americans don't want to study math? You hear that in the paper all the time. One of the things that is very pronounced that I got my PhD in 1975. Fortunately, I didn't want to be an academic, and I went to work at Sandia Labs. But there were no academic jobs. The job market for PhDs was horrible. Well, they also found, in fact, that they could attract as the number of students decreased, universities had to begin to import international students into their graduate programs. And in fact, the research capacities of universities around the country, beginning in the mid-70s, increased. Now, this has been true everywhere. So universities that used to be just teaching universities could begin to attract international scholars who could bring in research grants. They began to think that, oh my gosh, maybe we could start bringing in research grants into the university. So the complexion of mathematics departments changed. So as the departments became better and better, we found the following sort of interesting trend. The number of math majors began to decrease. So in 1985, there were something like 13,000 math majors. In 2005, there were 12,000 math majors. The quality of our math departments increased. The number of math majors decreased. That's an odd situation. In fact, the situation is even worse than that. Because when you look at the percentage of math majors compared to the total population at our universities, it decreased. So beginning in the 80s, we started to see more students coming at our universities. In particular, Hispanic students began to arrive. Minority students began to arrive at our universities. And yet, somehow, they didn't study mathematics. So one argument is that that Americans don't want to study math. Well, here's data from the Calculus AB exam. So this is an exam in high school that you take for first semester calculus. And you see that there are almost 250,000 students taking this exam in high school. There are also another 250,000 taking calculus at the community colleges. So we have 500,000 students taking calculus in high school. There are 80,000 students taking second semester calculus AB exam. Now here's an amazing statistic. There are 16,000 students taking the second semester calculus exam before their junior year. That's a huge number of students. That's more than the number of math majors. I just don't believe that Americans don't want to study mathematics. So you heard me say, right, that the job market was terrible. In fact, it's not right. The academic job market was terrible. The jobs for PhDs in mathematics was terrible. So I have a conjecture. My conjecture is that mathematicians don't think that math is useful. Professional mathematicians think that the only reason you get an undergraduate degree in math is because you're going to get a graduate degree in math. Otherwise, why would you study mathematics? The job market for bachelor's degrees in mathematics is actually wonderful. Everybody is looking for mathematics majors, but academics haven't quite figured that out. And because of that, we've seen this decrease in the number of mathematics majors. So I was giving a talk at a Midwest university once on something, and then they asked me to talk about diversity issues. And so I pointed out, I have a program to increase the number of math majors. Somebody got up in public and said, why should we encourage minorities to study mathematics when the job market is so bad? You know, he's looking out for us. Isn't this nice? So I happen to think that the minority population should participate in all aspects of American life, and we deserve the opportunity to be unemployed mathematicians. On another occasion, I was on something at NSF, and again, this issue came up, and a mathematician got up and said he doesn't recommend mathematics to his undergraduates, again, for that same reason, because the job market is so bad. Now, you know, we're constantly complaining about the K-12 educational system. These teachers aren't well prepared, and they're doing a terrible job. And yet, here at the university, we're making these public pronouncements about students not pursuing advanced degrees in mathematics. Of course, if we decrease the number of students studying mathematics, we decrease the potential of our domestic students pursuing, and so, of course, we have to rely on international students. And I think that mathematicians don't understand the usefulness of an undergraduate degree And I think this is where we need to start placing emphasis. So this decrease in the pipeline has adversely affected minority populations. In fact, I know many minority institutions that have very small numbers of minority math majors, yet they have research mathematicians on their staff. So here are some conversations that I've had with department heads. So I tell a department head, you know, there's this very promising Chicano mathematician on the market this year. And the response is, we hired one last year. Or pointing out to the head of a department whose university is 95% Hispanic, I tell him, you don't have a single Chicano mathematician on your staff. He says, why do we need one? Had a conversation with the university president. You know, there's no Chicano faculty on your staff. And he says, well, why don't we just go to Latin America? And there have to be a lot of them there. So in 1978, I did a survey of Chicano mathematicians in the Southwest. Right? And I looked at PhD granting institutions. So here's the data that I found. This is 1978. There were eight Chicano mathematicians in the Southwest. David Sanchez was at UCLA, moved to New Mexico. He's now retired. Richard Griego, he's retired. Bill Torres left academia. Joaquin Bustos recently died. Oh, there's Richard Tapia, Efraim, and myself, and Francisco. So I picked out PhD granting institutions because in mathematics, research is the name of the game. Right? So this is the data in 2004. So we went from 8 to 11. New Mexico has no Chicano mathematicians. The UC system, except for Francisco, and I'm sure he's retired, has no. Who's talking about us? Who's keeping us in the news there? I don't think anyone is. So given the current pipeline problems, I think it is difficult to find talented minority students for our faculty lines. We really have to start paying attention to recruiting domestic students into our graduate programs because the current percentages are out of balance. Now, there are departments who have developed models to address these issues. So I'll just mention a couple at the end. And there are mathematicians who have had dramatic impacts on minority participation. So one question is, why aren't these models being followed? So one organization I need to mention is the Society for the Advancement of Chicanos and Native Americans in Science. In fact, one of the past presidents, David Burgess, who's at Boston College, is in the audience. This is a wonderful organization. And faculty members attending a SACNAS conference, by the way, just how many have attended a SACNAS conference? Okay. Well, I hope more of you will do so. There is something amazing about attending this conference of 2,500, 3,000 people. One of the things that I did when I was president is I started the biography project. I felt that in our communities, we were not going to have minority science models for generations to come. So I thought we could create some biographies online where students could see that, in fact, people just like themselves can succeed. And in fact, SACNAS has just developed these wonderful videos of about eight minority scientists, which are on the web, and it's at that website. The Iowa Alliance is really an amazing activity. So the three state universities in Iowa have decided to come together to have an impact on increasing diversity. And currently at the University of Iowa, 25% of the students are minority students. Really quite amazing. There are some people who have done just amazing things. Carlos Castillo Chavez, who is now at Arizona State University, has an entire industry. He ran a summer REU program at Cornell for minority students about 10 years ago. He had 20 slots. How are you going to find 20 minorities? He had over 100 applications, again, proving that if there are opportunities, we will come. Richard Tapia is famous for the work that he has done at Rice University, not so well known as Javier Rojo, who runs this summer program in statistics. So let me just talk a little bit about my own efforts at the University of Arizona. So I took on this position in about 2003, and I told the department head I would double the number of math majors. Okay, so it hasn't quite happened, though actually that number was quite inflated. Our bookkeeping wasn't good, so now we have great bookkeeping records. So this year we'll have about 570 math majors. We've had a sizable percentage of minority students. The number of minors is almost the same as the number of majors, and we'll be graduating about 100 math majors, and 20% of those are minority students. And I'd be happy to talk to individuals about techniques to increase minority students. I just didn't want to do that here. So in closing, how do we increase diversity? Well, first of all, I think we have to start paying more attention to undergraduate students. We have to increase the pool. And focusing on recruiting faculty into faculty lines, that's way too long range. We just have not worked at trying to increase the number of undergraduates. Now, one of the things that I do is I invite students into the major. So I send out probably 5,000 messages a semester telling students that I think that they should be adding the math major. Here's a schedule of courses. Here's some opportunities that would come your way by adding more mathematics to your undergraduate schedule. I personally think that the best recruiting technique that we have are our classes. Our classes are the most effective tool for recruiting students. And of course, as we talk about increasing the number of math majors, we also have to be worrying about increasing opportunities for them. So I want to thank you very much for your attention and for this opportunity to talk at MIT.